This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
This talk represents the work of both of us. We do everything together. But I'm actually going to be reading the words tonight, and Matt's going to...
I'm going to press the buttons.
Press the buttons. And then, but when you can interrupt us at any point, and also in the discussion, you know, ask either one of us anything. So I think I'll just get started. This talk represents a portion of our practice. We've organized it thematically in terms of the disaster leap project, but also how that finds itself elsewhere in the practice. And so we put together kind of array of things we do. But we do a lot of other stuff too. We're not showing you tonight. Anyway, here goes. In the newspaper photos, the blue burqa glides down the street, a bell-shaped tent bound to the body within only at the crown. Our Western eyes see it as a blackout cover of a birdcage or a form of mobile house arrest. But for the willing wearer, it is a tool in the domestication of urban space. Take, for example, contemporary Algerian women of Brussels, who did not wear veils in Algiers, but have adopted them in Brussels as a matter of comfort and privacy, a drapery drawn across their window to the boulevard of a new and strange city. And that's actually true. It's a true phenomenon in Brussels. These projects that we're going to show you today explore similarly transpositions of location, material, and scale among body, furnishings, and architecture. Part one has kind of three parts. Roy Schauer. A while ago, we completed a small interior furnishing that has become a kind of obsessive reference and an ideogram for us under the shorthand designation of Roy Schauer. So much so that we often talk of our work in the office of it's like Roy Schauer or it's different from Roy Schauer. The original 1908 grand apartments of Roy's building, which is seen in red, were summarily butchered after the crash of 1929, such that Roy occupied an original dining room, living room, and library of the first grand apartment, into which a kitchen and bath had been inserted. And you can see on the left is the living. I guess it's on the right is the living room, is his living room. In the middle is the library, which has been subdivided with a wall that goes smack in the middle of a window to make that little bathroom. And on your right is the dining room of the original apartment that took fully half of the... that was the original apartment. We understood his brief to redo the kitchen as his desire to restore the pre-depression grandeur, the library window, and the enfilade of movement and view along the river. And from that first map, you saw that it was facing this way. The Hudson River was just to the left. Anyway, to restore the view along the river without increasing the square footage, to restore the sense of space without adding any, we understood that he wanted to inhabit the apartment both according to the mores of 1908, when space was luxurious because cooking and bodily functions were hidden away, and also he wanted to occupy it according to current desires for bathrooms and kitchens as elegant and public as the former library. Given all this, we had to put the bathroom in a box and move it to the foyer. Matt, could you go back to the plan for a sec? Yeah. And there you have the... I don't have a pointer except my finger. Here is the insertion of the you'll understand to be the new kitchen and the new bathroom into the foyer, restoring the original library. We're going to show some pictures that move around it. So now we want to do the next. So that's looking from the foyer. The center portion. you're looking from the foyer through the center portion, which is the shower, with the bathroom to the right, and storage and pantry to, I mean, the bathroom is to
left.
Your left, right, and the pantry and storage for the kitchen is to your right. And if you, do the next, then if you flip to the other side, which is facing the windows along Riverside Drive, that's the other side where you see the entrance into that bathroom. You're looking towards the north, towards the living room, and the other part of that, the box, houses the rest of the kitchen. And you want to keep going? I think we have a couple more slides. That's then looking off the lot, across the windows, onto the river. And onto the Hudson, and want to try the next one? Right, and then now we've gone into the shower, that center portion. And so when you saw the body to begin with, they were standing in there. And that's looking towards the kitchen. And the next? And the next? Great. Okay. So the and I guess maybe one more. Yeah, great. So this is the framework for that shower. This box is a small Mesian skyscraper, really. A solid section steel and glass enclosure on four structural posts with roof girders cantilevered to either side and secondary beams hung from those girders. I think you can see all that. Steel U-sections, those are little posts sticking out, serve as brackets for the glass shelves. It stands independent of the apartment with its own little footings, which you see at the bottom, which are submerged into the floor slab, and its roof structure opening onto the sky of the new skylight. And to understand its relation to kind of Mesian practice, you know, here's the Mesian skyscraper with the steel frame in the middle. And actually, the thing it's most akin to is the Farnsworth House diagrammatically. And the next one, you really see that in plan, where there's the core. And the next, looking through the house. And the next, great, it's back to ours. Originally, of course, when the center room was the library and the pocket door was open, you could see directly through the apartment to the Hudson. We reconstructed the view through the mirror on the door. So you can see the Hudson now. You can't see straight through. This is the new window, but we brought it in around through the mirror on that door. That's the Hudson. We reconstructed the view through the mirror on the door. It brings the city view of the river deep inside the apartment. So this shower enclosure, and it's the white frame, which is that steel frame. Has become an ideogram for us. There are three principles condensed within the ideogram of the shower. Number one, it's a freestanding, self-supporting object and enclosure nested within an existing shell, and it doesn't disturb the shell it touches. Number two, this nested structure is required by the dysfunction of the existing shell. In other words, the original rooms needed this new furnishing in order to work as an apartment. Without it, there was no bathroom, there was no kitchen, it was incomplete. And number three, the added element is a hyper-programmed armoire, pantry, refrigerator, shelving unit, window shade. It has many accessible sides that can independently respond to their adjacencies and brings new patterns of use. So it's kind of hyper-functioning, it's multi-programmed aspects is the third principle. Now, there's a two-part coda to this story in which Roy Shower is displaced materially, translated, and transformed as Roy and his wife Anne migrate within the space of the building. Two years later, Roy and Anne had a child, and the population density of the apartment house again was increased. To house the new child, we made another Roy Shower, this time in wood, opening it on one side to make a creche. So there you see Roy Shower in black and the new wood version, which is the room for the kid in red. And we have a couple of pictures to show you what that was like. So now you're looking past the Mesian frame steel and glass of Roy Schauer to the wood, straight through. They're aligned.
And the addition of the screen to keep the kid from pulling the stuff off the shelf.
And you're getting closer. And then that, actually, they at that point they'd taken the crib out, but that's where the crib lied. And also, this is always understood as temporary. In fact, when the kid got to a certain age, they gave it to somebody else who put it in their apartment. Unable to acquire an adjacent apartment, Roy and Andrew then were going to have another kid. So, and unable to acquire the adjacent apartment, they bought the remote fragment of the 1908 original that had originally been the servants' quarters and second bedroom. They gave away the crash and constructed another double-sided multi-purpose armoire that winds its way around the existing structure. And there you see it pulled out in red. And now we're going to walk around it for a second. So that's the profile of the new piece, the kind of compressed Roy Schauer from the side that goes all the way through that fragment of the apartment. Now we're walking along its edge. Right. And that's the other side, the flip side of it. Oh, that's crooked, isn't it? We're walking along. You'll see buried inside of it is the bathroom. That's a glass window on the top. At night, it kind of lights up. And you want to go into the bathroom? Right. Let me see. Going from one side of the armoire, and this is from the other side, if you're on the other side of that wall, going in. And there's just a corner detail in the bathroom. The family dream, I don't know if there's another shot or not. Nope, back there. The family dreams of acquiring the one missing piece of that grand original apartment, because they have the kind of the front and the back of it now. But for now, they traverse the common building corridor between their living rooms and bedrooms, between diurnal states, as if between the houses on a boulevard. You know, so it's the internalized Brussels Boulevard inside their house. Okay, part two, refugees. Freed from the red tape of the nation state, embodying his or her own cultural identity, and stowing accessories in a carry-on bag, the Western contemporary nomad who descended from the romantic landscape of Goethe, picture here from Goethe's Jung Werther, wandering through Europe, then traversed the propertyless state of work and leisure in the diurnal landscape of Le Corbusier's radiant city, you know, which was also predicated on a modern nomad who has no property and moves from a state of leisure where they live in the unités to a state of work in these towers in the luxuriant park. So that's one iteration of the modern nomad, finally descending into the kind of Deleuzian idea of nomad. We encountered this modern nomad for the last time in a recent design competition we did that was sponsored by Alessi, the Italian company, who were looking to furnish those on the shuttle with global capital and who they specifically named urban nomads. And they had a competition to design the kind of accoutrements and the accessories that would replace the house and make a new kind of house on the move for these globe-trotting haute bourgeois, I guess. Anyway, we designed her a utility belt for personal tools, and that's what we designed, and also a portable computer station that would now both fail to make it through airport metal. And now both these things, unfortunately, would no longer make it through airport metal detectors. So then she and her companion, I guess, detained in the airport lounge since September 11th, or perhaps since Genoa, she contemplates the parts of societies that the flow of global capital has bypassed, the resources it siphons off in its wake, and the people forcibly pushed along with it. We are now, by all, and I don't know who I'm lecturing to, most architects and also the literati who sometimes come to these lectures are probably familiar with Deleuze and Guattari's depiction of the phenomenon nomadology, which sets up two moments. The state asserting its authority through a kind of space they call striated or gridded, with, you know, like a city with spatial grids of power. And then the other moment is the nomad, who uses a war machine to expand its smooth territory, and that territory is often described as a desert. The tribe left out of this Nietzschean dualism of conquest are the victims, who are neither nomadic nor stationary, who are neither inside nor outside the city by their own free will, but rather displaced. The subject's clients of this next piece are the displaced, the doppelgangers of Roy's interior phenomenon of spread and Alessi's exterior phenomenon of flight. They are the other products of Cold War geopolitics inhabiting the society of scarcity beneath our culture of abundance. And we can leave that up for a bit. Okay? As quantified by the United Nations, one in every 297 persons on this planet is displaced. And it's really an amazing statistic when you think about it. One in 300 people is either a refugee or displaced. Until 1993, displaced meant refugee, but the conflicts of the past decade have led to a formal recognition of the IDP, the internally displaced person, forced from their home, but not their region or country. There are 25 million IDP. That is the population equivalent to double the world's largest city. So if you take the world's largest city, which is probably now, you know, in
Mexico City.
What, pardon?
Mexico
it's
City.
Now Mexico City, you know, in Pudong, you could think of China, you could think of Mexico City. If you double that, that's how many displaced people there are right now. The dominant, and this refers to this as well, the dominant architecture of displacement, that of the refugee camp, seems a dark legacy of the international style of military operations, outposts of striated rationality and Western functional planning that are unaffected by all our postmodern lessons of regionalism and cultural memory. And here you see, you know, one of these gridded kind of Cartesian decumanist military-like outposts that's actually a refugee camp. And it's more than ironic coincidence that the alternative to the TARP campground site is usually a disused military barracks, and they often use now military barracks for refugee camps. It is in the nature of current warfare that the military camp has lost its value as a staging ground for battles that are now ideally fought by a virtual infantry with cyber intelligence or a kind of deployable nomadic war machine. A competition sponsored by Architecture for Humanity and War Child, with the support of the UN and USAID, called for alternatives to refugee housing, in this case specifically for Kosovo. But the brief addressed only the most obvious symptom of displacement, the temporary shelter. The brief was, for the competition, that the shelters were to be constructed of an absolute minimum of materials. They warned that even tarps were hard to come by. They had to be erected within 48 hours, but they would then accommodate inhabitants for up to as long as 2 years. There was no discussion of sanitary conditions, bathrooms, or kitchens, because the normative provisions, like group latrines and soup kitchens, were assumed to be de rigueur. There was no mention of schools, cultural facilities, despite the projected length of stay. There was no description of the plan of the camps, their geographic locations, their environmental situations, or of the desires of the refugees. And we're using this image to kind of state the desires of refugees. It's actually part of a tent city in India, and it is, from our research, we realize that the most universal desire is for a TV, truly. You know, forget running water. Anyway, our proposed emergency shelter consists of, although running water is a desire, but a TV is really kind of the thing that people, because they want to be hooked in, then you're really dislocated, right, if you're not plugged. Our proposed emergency shelter, and you could see that we actually won this competition. We don't always win. Our proposed emergency shelter consists of two freestanding steel frame boxes with top and bottom pallets of glass-reinforced concrete and various infill panels, such as fiberglass for the transmission of light, metal for the transmission of heat, and locally procured straw for insulation. One of these boxes is, in fact, a privy, or a bathroom, which is on your left. Thank you very much. And the other as a kitchen. I shouldn't be able to do that. I'm an architect, right? As a kitchen with integral cistern and shower. And you see the kitchen with the integral cistern in yellow. On the flip side, there's another spout and curtain for the shower. Placed at a distance from one another, they frame a habitable space wide enough to accommodate a bed. The enclosing tarp is now a photovoltaic blanket whose power, stored in a battery, can run that universally desired TV. And here's, there's a little study model we made of it with the privy and its vent and the translucency. And there's the metal panels that transmit the heat to the sleeping area. And I guess the next. Okay, and this is this board I'm going to keep up for a while. It shows how the thing is assembled. Those are the steps shown. The transport and ease of assembly of these boxes in rough terrain is key. Disassembled into modular panels and stacked between the protective pallets and tied for shipping, the two boxes, when they're collapsed, have total volume of 1,000 millimeters by around 1,000 millimeters, or almost square. The cistern barrel holds the miscellaneous components. 20 such shelters fit in a standard 20-foot shipping container, which in itself will ultimately be used as a communal structure. Hoisted from the truck via the grips provided on the pallets and placed on the site, we estimate a team of four can erect the emergency shelter in 6 hours using a single wrench. So that would be the 48 hours by 42 hours, and obviously it had to stay up for at least 2 years. A major component of our proposal is its assertion that the refugee camp itself be rethought in terms of its design and operation, and indeed in terms of its very existence. The boxes are together a condensed infrastructure, bathroom, kitchen, obviating the need for group latrines and soup kitchens. They can be paired as individual homes or grouped as clustered dwelling with expanded cooking and bathroom facilities. You can get community sharing, communal kitchens, and smaller clusters. Most significantly, the kits are the potential core for subsequent housing on the sites of permanent dwelling, whether that be damaged homes, ruins, the cleared lots of cities and villages, or fields. And you see it inserted in the town of Pristina right there. Initially spanned by that tarp, the distance can be subsequently framed with beams, because the shelter's really strong, those steel things, so that the shelter becomes a core and a scaffold for the construction of a house around it. And you see that beginning in the axonometric drawing there, but we've got some more shots too. This is an alternate version we're working on right now where it folds down and collapses rather than it's made out of panels. We just got this grant, so now we're starting to think, what else can this thing be? And this is kind of an metal origami version.
It works like a car jack where it would actually have a thread drawn between the two pieces, and you can turn it and it would expand of its own. One of the big concerns is that it might be assembled by women or children. They wouldn't have a lot of men around
because
they
would
be in jail or they'd be in prisoner of war camps. So we're worried about the weight of it, but also about getting the thing to lift up.
All right. Even I can change a tire. Right? here's a little sketch of what it might look like domesticated, kind of within, having arrived at one of these ruined sites. What are the first moves? Do you have you attach to the wall, you try to make a living room in between. So the idea is that the project challenges the existence of the refugee camp altogether, with the possibility of the immediate return of the people to the sites of their future or former homes, even if those sites are depleted unformed or deprived of larger orders of infrastructure. The idea is you don't have to wait for them to rebuild the whole plumbing system of a city in order to have people recoup their property. And of course, social fabrics and social infrastructures are the things that unravel the quickest. And if you delay returning people home for years, all notions of property and community are usually gone. It's very, very difficult. We have kind of slick beginning of a computer drawing of that thing as well, with the two boxes on the left, the bed in the middle, kind of framing out to the reconstituted wall. So as self-supporting, multi-directional, hyper-programmed, inhabited objects that will eventually nest within a larger architectural shell, which they restore, these boxes are Roy Schauer. I mean, and they kind of formally look like Roy Schauer, too. It kind of inverts where the boxes is. Here, the initial displacement of the interior to the outdoors is not just a surrealist trope, as in Roy's, however, but also an extreme physical condition. The subsequent wrapping of the object to restore its interiority is likewise instrumental in terms of gross physical functioning. In the resultant house, the boxes are buried as a trace. The space of the city and the order of the state are reconstituted in a kind of uneasy truce between the idea of place and displacement. The buried core, you know, and so this could really remain within the house, kind of buried within the finished house. The buried core has no deterministic role in this future order, but it suggests possibilities. And then we like to use, as opposed to Deleuze, the powerful lens of Gottfried Semper, who is the great architectural theorist of the nomadic to us, for whom the mobile hearth is the primal architectural element, and you see it in the bottom, in the center, and the wall is a textile descended from the hung carpet of a tent. His idea was, you know, that there were four elements of architecture, that the first building was in fact a tent, that the elements and that was understood not as a shape, but elementally, in terms of the hearth, the hung carpet, the frame that gave the roof for the enclosure. And like for Semper, the nomadic content of architecture is never lost, for it is inscribed, for Semper, it's inscribed in the patterning of brick, which for him is the textile nature of the original wall, the rugs that were hung. Or what might one continue in the translucent Mesian screen and its utility core, you know, the Farnsworth House. It's kind of translation of that notion of hearth and nomadic frame. Okay, and part three, this is the last part of the talk. We're doing okay. We call it indwelling. The United Nations High Commission of Refugees list of impediments to counting displaced persons is very telling, because they say, well, it's hard to know how many people are displaced. You know who's in a refugee camp, but it's hard to count those who hide out, those who refuse to be identified, those who move around out of fear. And this describes another architecture of displacement, which we've called indwelling. The refuge is the in the house of the relative or an acquaintance. It is in the cheap hotel. It is in the disused hotel. It is in the abandoned school or in the underutilized monastery or even in the hospital bed. These accommodations are almost always fleeting because of the pressure exerted on overcrowded households, the anxiety of the host institution, the fickleness of local policy. In these circumstances, the refugee remains somewhat within the community of society rather than, you know, outside in a camp, often scavenging employment and maintaining personal networks, even though those people are really displaced from property, family, and profession. This indwelling blurs the condition of the refugee and that of the urban squatter and the illegal immigrant. And Here we have a slum outside of Rio, one of the favelas, which I think makes that rather evident. The single equation of resource scarcity, population pressure, and mobility places refugee camps and homelessness along a single Mobius strip of displacement. Around a year after we won the competition for Kosovo, the housing organization Common Ground Community asked Marguerite McGoldrick and ourselves to develop a new kind of flop house, meaning a type of demountable room that would stand within a larger loft space as an alternative to this kind of armory type shelter. And everybody says these don't exist anymore. This is from the New York Times 3 weeks ago. And in fact, it was part of an article where they say they were closing this down and the people in it had nowhere to go. Common Ground described the intended users as the mobile homeless who would occupy this shelter and its related social programs as a first step on the way to more stable existence, and therefore they called it first step housing. As housing to stabilize the dispossessed, it seemed to us another form of disaster relief. Here in New York, capital of hypercapital, I know we're not in New York right now, I'm part of the Midwest, also, but this was for New York. So in New York, capital of hypercapital, at one end of the looped flow of global investment and displacement, far from the scarcity of drought and famine, the housing shortage is a scarcity that's fabricated within a culture of abundance to fuel demand. There's not enough housing that makes it worth more. Building codes and zoning resolutions, for all their laudable protective measures, also function as mechanisms of scarcity and their rigid attitudes towards square footage, program, and materials. The housing policy of New York asserts the primacy of the normative apartment with distinct bedroom and kitchen to the exclusion of alternative types. They no longer allow SROs. For example, single room occupancy. The populations most affected by the exclusion are those without economic resources, but it has an impact on many non-traditional idiosyncratic city dwellers as well, even Roy. Our first step housing, maybe we'll just show them a model of the unit. This is a little model. We actually built it, but there's a model. Our first step housing remains literally sightless because 20 years ago, the city of New York outlawed, as I said, the SRO and the flop house. The only recourse for building this stuff is to renovate an existing flop house, which they call grandfathering in, a pre-existing use. But to do this is difficult because the remaining flop houses on the Bowery is in the eastward path of Soho's expansion and gentrification. Therefore, the most legitimate venues for these things, and we show where they've been built, was in a gallery space in New York where the user client focus groups came and studied it. You know, so we had homeless people coming in, living in these things in the art gallery. With the inevitable ironies of art in an age of commodity, the gallery visitors were also quite intrigued with the possibility of using it in their loft. What distinguishes the client users of these projects from many other homeless people, according to Common Ground, who hired us, was that they resist being housed. These were people where you couldn't get them off the street. That's why they were trying these little houses. They have chosen their conditions of physical dislocation, as opposed to a refugee, for example, who has no choice. These resistant users reminded us time and time again that they're homeless, that they were homeless, but not destitute or standards of conditions. They weren't going to go just into anything. That's why they were homeless. They considered their rights to include acknowledgement of the permanences they did have, their informal communities, their locales, be it their street corner, their habits, their possessions, even if they were in shopping carts. They shared in the upscale population's desires for the modern home. Light, air, space, cleanliness, order, comfort, privacy, security, a sense of place, and beauty. They required that these recognizable standards of living come in alternative social configurations, that they come in ways that they not normally be available. Consequently, the fact that these things appealed to gallery visitors, loft dwellers, and our resistant users seemed to us our greatest measure of success. And here you saw the one unit. This is two units back to back because they can be attached to each other. So you have the door open, that the metal divider is the division between the two units. So the one with the first step housing is the back of the unit. So fundamental to the room design is the effort to create degrees of privacy, despite the circumscribed situations of this project where a kind of Foucauldian surveillance was a fact. The rooms provide security of person and possessions through a locked door, armoire, and roofing. And the thing that bumps out and makes a porch on the front is actually an armoire, except a closet for their stuff from the inside.
Yeah, and that's right.
There are three sliding panels, and we might have to go to the next slide to see all three. You can see that's one of the clients. I'm one of the people, user clients. There are so many clients, but that's the user client from a flop house on the Bowery. And there is a screen door. So there are three sliding panels, a solid core door with a lock set, a translucent cow wall panel that's a kind of opening window, and a perforated metal closet screen. So that's the closet door, and it's perforated for ventilation. But you can also use it as the door to the unit, where it also provides a kind of openness. So they offer different degrees of transparency from within the unit to the outside. Any one can be opened or used within the doorway. All three are set back from the exterior edge of the closet to create this kind of transition zone and a porch. So you want to show the next? Because you can see actually all three in a row right there. Each unit on the in, and now you're looking inside that yellow unit. Actually, the two units are two different color schemes. We're going to look inside this one, the yellow one. Okay, it's opening. And that has a desk there. Okay, so let's stop there for a minute. Each unit has individually controlled electric service. No TV, but there is a radio in this one. They could have a TV. In the chase between the panels, pre-drilled flange holes for hanging items, which include the desk in this case. It's hung from that. Ample storage for personal possessions. Conceivably, the people who live there could choose the color and finish of the panels, which are actually plastic laminate or plywood, depending how they're finished, the arrangement of the furnishings, the roof shape even, and the size and plan of the unit. And I'll explain how that works right now. And so here's the corner where you start to see how that it's a frame and panel system. In their structural and component system, flexibility and ease of deployment, this housing's very much like Kosovo, right? So it's a frame system with panels. It is a kit of parts, some of which, like the aluminum sections you see here, are customized and prefabricated for the housing, others of which, like the plywood, are readily available and standard products. The fundamental component is a single custom cruciform aluminum extrusion that can be cut to any length or extended through the attachment of elements. And I think we have... No, it's okay. So here you have... we'll get back to this in a minute. But here you have the one unit and then a double unit where you take out one of the walls and you can actually... We had two units as two separate dwellings, but you can make larger units as well. I'll talk about that in a minute. But you want to do the next so they can see the component? Yes, there it is. So that the whole thing's just made out of that. That's the columns and the beams. Intermediate pieces. The systems, and also it kind of looks like Mises cruciform, don't you think?
Just a little.
The system's strength and stability depends on the connection of the frame to the panels of the standard sheathing. This hybrid construction allows the frame to be very small. Remember, it's aluminum, not steel. This stuff is incredibly light. You can toss these things in the air. Hence, it's cheaper, easily shipped, like disaster relief housing or IKEA furniture. The horizontal braces actually rest on the panels, yet are strong enough to support, as you saw, the desk. And a team of two can erect those two units in a half a day, and we know because we're the ones who put them up. So a lot of the criteria we use for ourselves in writing the brief for this were the same as the criteria from Kosovo. And you want to do the next? That's fine.
Okay.
That's fine. I think this is the last paragraph. Common Ground's brief was for single men separately housed in individual rooms. But as you saw from our combined plans, for us it did not define the limits of this project. For us, just as with the SEED project for the rebuilding of Kosovo, the Frein system descended from the Mesian cruciform and its attendant universal space allows for a variety and conglomerations of units, sizes, and configurations, clusters, mats, networks of social and physical connections for potential new landscapes. That's the end. So we want to go.
Okay.
I didn't even need this. I hope that. So I don't know if anybody has any questions or comments. We'd love your comments or your questions.
Hi.
What?
Can you get electric service to those units?
The cruciform, you saw the thing that's the distortion of the, are you an architect?
Yeah.
Okay, so the thing that's the distortion of the Mesian column, right, which is freestanding, is in these, the reason it's cruciform is so that we can attach a panel on both sides of the flange. So you have the four flanges, you can attach a panel on both sides, therefore there's a chase, that's the dimension of the flange, between each of the panels.
Right.
Here it's hollow. There are two plywood panels. And actually, you don't always have two. On the outside, if it's freestanding, then you only have one, which is why you saw the frame from the outside. But if you have attached units, you get two panels and a space in between.
In the gallery space, you see this conduit, and it runs up to the ceiling, and we actually plugged it into one of the gallery lights. Typically, you'd probably just have conduit running along the ceiling. It would drop down into every unit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a good question.
And does that count for bathrooms and things like that?
No, this one does not. This one, you have the group latrine. This one has no, it was created for these specific interior conditions. You probably could take that closet and make it into a privy, and you could weatherproof the thing. I don't know.
In this setting, because of the New York City code, and what we're doing, you have to understand, is what has happened is that there used to be hundreds of thousands of people housed like this, literally, right? Now there's like 2,000, and they're in existing lofts on the Bowery, and they were industrial lofts, and they have little rooms. The man that we saw before, he's a bit of a celebrity because he gets to go on the radio every now and then.
Neat.
That guy, he's lived in a room that's 6 feet square for 30 years. Okay, so.
He thought this was like.
Yeah, wow. The deluxe
so
version.
So
you know,
he said, you know, you could do business here.
It's really great. Okay. But consequently, because what we've had to do, The objective for our client was to rebuild one of these existing places where these guys live, one of these existing flop houses, and because they were hoping that it would be successful, they would be able to get the laws for the city of New York to change so that they could build more of them.
Right.
They can't build a new one from scratch. So consequently, what they've had to do is use the existing infrastructure of the buildings where these flop houses already exist, which means they will use group latrines because that's what they did 100 years ago when the whole idea started. But that isn't to say that they couldn't be adapted to give private bathrooms. The system's very flexible. You change the size of the panel and you put a plumbing riser and you're done. Yeah?
Yeah.
I had a chance to look at the images before. I was most impressed that there was lockable space because from what conversations I've had, a lot of people won't go to shelters because they don't have a place to lock up their stuff.
Right.
But on the devil's advocate side, did you encounter any friction under the concept of surveillance from people who said if these people can lock the dwelling and lock stuff into the closet,
yeah,
is that an issue?
It's really, I mean, the whole process was incredibly interesting that way because there were so many parties to be heard from. You know, the fire department had one set of rules, the state of New York had another set of rules, HPD, the Housing Preservation Development of New York City had one, then there was the organization Common Ground and the clients. And so anything you see here was negotiated, and they had to approve it in the end. And in fact, no one therefore ultimately opposed locking it. You know, the had to be ADA, had to be handicapped accessible. What allows for the surveillance to occur anyway to a certain extent is the roof. Because of the fire department, you can't have a solid roof because it has to be sprinkled.
Would the concept be that whoever is sort of a house master in one of these spaces would have access to all the units?
They would have a master key.
Yeah.
But
I have to say they respect, the people who run these places have great respect for the people who live in them, who are truly worthy of their respect, you know.
Yeah. The client, we viewed this project as being able to transform to meet other program needs. The specific program that we were handed, though, understood that these would be a place for people to stay for less than a month at a time.
Well, that's true, too.
And so their hope was that people would come here to stay for 28 days because there was legal reasons through the city of New York that would dictate how long they could stay before they had certain rights as renters, and they didn't want to give them those rights because what they hope is that they would move them to more permanent shelters. So in the minds of the clients, the people who would be here might have contraband, but they were also there to find more permanent solutions where they could get counseling and they could go to a place where they might have a group situation for counseling or group help. That what they really needed was a place where they could lock their stuff securely so they could go to a job interview.
That's very heartening that they were able to allow you to keep that in the design.
Yeah. More questions?
Yeah, I have a question.
Okay.
You guys wear a lot of hats, academics and theorists and practitioners. Has your disaster relief structures rebounded and made you, given you more opportunities to build domestic spaces? More bourgeois spaces?
Nope.
In a word?
Nope. It's part of the culture. People love to pigeonhole you. We have to fight not to become the disaster.
we do a lot of other work. We do a lot of residential work in restaurants, like a lot of small New York firms, but we don't get those jobs because of these projects. These projects and those projects coexist. But
in our mind, it's the same. I mean, that was the part of the argument of this, which, you know, this is a lecture we like to give to students a lot because it's an argument for how the same problem gets framed differently, but it's the same.
But, yeah. I mean, also, I think for us, the especially the Kosovo work is as much an urban argument as it is an architectural argument that by not creating new refugee camps, you're saving the environment, you're saving natural resources. I mean, the entire country of Rwanda has been decimated by the internal conflicts there, not because the war itself has caused so much physical damage, but because the movement of people from one location to another, they've torn down all the trees to make tent poles and to burn for fuel. And by trying to reestablish existing communities, it's a way of curtailing any physical damage that's being done to the environment.
Your projects succeed on so many fronts. Are there any shortcomings that you guys feel now looking back upon it?
Well, I think we're not satisfied with the disaster relief passing yet. I mean, we're not totally satisfied with this in a lot of ways, too. We would redo the entry, I think. I mean, it could have lights. It could have a mailbox. There could be it could be much more elaborated. To us, this is almost schematic. And I think in the end, you know, the Kosovo stuff, it's not beautiful yet. And I think ultimately, there's no reason why it shouldn't be in conventional terms. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we have found that the people who find themselves in the position where they live are in the position to actually inhabit one of these things would shock you in their, I mean, it's our own preconceptions, but in their level of taste, education, intellect, they're not
numbed aesthetically. It's not that they don't pay attention. They're incredibly sensitive to the qualities of their physical surroundings. So they're a wonderful group. And their criticism is something we take very seriously. And we're happy to say that while not perfect, they do like these things as environments. They like the materiality. They like the cleanliness. They don't, you know, as opposed to everyone living in the new urbanism, they actually like modern stuff, you know. So it's been, in that way, they're the best client group we've probably ever had.
The client for this Common Ground renovates older buildings as well and has people live in them. And this is the second forum where we did an installation. The first one was within this extremely grand New York hotel with gold gilding and everything that they renovated to make this new housing. And in that context, it was very stark contrast, but it still got incredible positive response and continues to. They bring client user groups through all the time to get responses, and they love it.
Yeah.
So it's very gratifying to us. But Deborah's right, the Kosovo stuff. We were the only entry. They had 1,200 entries for the Kosovo project. We were the only entry that had a bathroom or a kitchen out of 1,200 entries.
Ours was not the most beautiful. There were some really beautiful things that were much more, when I use beautiful in a kind of shorthand way to avoid a long discussion, but there were ones that were formally resolved much better than ours was.
They were the ones that got published in Surface magazine.
And we want ours to be like that too, but it's not there. We don't think it's there.
Yeah.
But partly it's the problems of the system.
Yeah, because in some ways we solved more demanding physical problems than some of the other competitors. The constraints, at least in the short time that we were able to dedicate to thinking through the problem, kind of dictated that there were harsher materials. And now, like with the folding box, I think we're starting to address how to solve problems that we posed for ourselves that were not part of the competition brief, and at the same time start to make it a more attractive object.
You like the folding ones? Hey, Matt made them. Yeah, so, okay, we'll take it that way.
In terms of the population you're dealing with in New York versus Kosovo, you have pointed out some similarities in essential needs that the people seem to have. In terms of the research you have done, with different cultures, have you found some extreme differences or some things to deal with that are very different in Kosovo?
That's a really good question. Because it brings home the whole notion of, it's such a good question. It's such a multifaceted question because, first of all, there's the existing solution, which is universal, which is the tent or the blue tarp, that really does not take into account cultural difference at all. And there's the problem of how these aid agencies operate and how willing they are to be culturally specific and how much they can be given the time they have to respond and all the problems of responding. So there's the issue of kind of the universal solution versus the specific solution and whether something like the system can have built into it not just a spatial flexibility, but a cultural responsiveness, that its hyper-programming means that it can respond to different cultural needs as well as the physical ones. And it's something that I don't think we're there yet, but we're really concerned with, because it's a concern that's in your question. And we found out some really interesting thing about Kosovo, for example, that for the Islamic population in Kosovo, you can't have the bathroom doors and the kitchen doors facing each other. And that it's so, even though we weren't sure the square was the right shape, now that we know this, we realize that whether it's square, it has to be able to rotate. We have to give people the ability to orient these different things different ways in order that they can then imprint it with their cultural habits. So it's this weird combination where we can't inscribe very specific cultural habits, but we have to understand what they are to allow the thing to be adapted. The other way it gets adapted is materially. It's a weird thing because you think, gee, you know, don't you want to build mud huts? We're in the land of the land of mud huts, and why would you want to use metal? And this goes back to what Matt was talking about, where you actually don't want to use the local materials because then you decimate the landscape. So it's a very strange, these kind of very pertinent questions of cultural identity are very strange when it comes to disaster relief housing. I don't know if I answered your question, but yeah.
I mean, part of it is probably also appropriation of the given space, right? I mean, I noticed the proof when you did the drawing,
Right. The Turkish poof. Yeah. The Ottoman.
One has to assume that it just has to transform.
Right.
I
think that's also the point, that because it's just this little kernel, that as it spreads out, it gets transformed.
Yeah, those look like big block walls, and these are kind of rubble walls, but they could be wood walls, or they could be anything. This is just to give them an initial place to sleep and hide, and then but somehow it's supposed to act as a structure that they can build on. It's scaffolding. It's really scaffolding ultimately in the long term, we hope. And that the panels could be kind of filled with local materials too is an important idea that we didn't express clearly in the initial drawings, which is something that's coming into the new development. Didn't quite understand that clearly at first. Yeah.
This is more about your practice and your growth into this kind of work. I see that there's an engagement with context, both spatial context for these units, political context. Mm-hmm. We talked about the zoning codes and limitations, political. And all of that, which I don't see as much emphasis on in architecture generally. How is it that you came either through your schooling or your self-schooling into this notion of a deeper engagement in other systems of play?
It's really interesting.
Thank you.
We're laughing because someone asked us this question last week.
Go ahead.
No.
I don't remember what we said.
Remember the lady from Fast Company? This is what she kept asking.
Yeah, I know. We got interviewed by a business magazine called Fast Company, and so there's this woman who's used to writing about .com entrepreneurs, but there aren't any more of those, so now they have to interview architects.
Right. who believe it or not, have lasted longer than the .comers.
Yeah.
Which is like,
no,
we have less.
So she wouldn't take no for an answer. She said, "Well, why do you do this?" And so we did. Well, because Deleuze said so. Now, and then we went, "Why do you do this?" And we said, "Well, because we really care about people." And they said, "But no, really, why do you do this?
Why do you care about people?" But I understand what you're saying. I mean, this is real. It's really an interesting question. It's a little disturbing question that it's not so embedded in the teaching of architecture and urban design as a discipline that it's obvious. I think the way you said it, though, in the way that this woman from Fast Company couldn't say it, you said, you talked a bit of it as contextualization. Well, the idea of different contexts, of overlap context, is very au courant. I mean, that's kind of what postmodernism is, to my understanding of the word, right? Or postmodernity. It is this kind of overlapping, the notion of the shifting context, that there's not a single context that creates a single solution for any problem. That it's always going to have context of time, space, user, you know, or other, whatever it is. So I think it comes out of current theory and practice. It's all around us in some way. We take it in a certain sense more literally. I mean, for us, homelessness is not a state of mind. Nomadism is not a metaphor. And partly we just find reality terribly engaging. and the notion that there are, that you can, that the these theoretical issues don't have to exist remote from dealing with reality, the most incredible situation that one can be in. I think I'm a little older than that, and so I can say that when I went to school, in architecture school, context was taught. But in a way that now our students, and we both teach, I would say that we find architecture very object oriented. And the only context is the screen or the virtual. And we have this new idea of landscape, but even that's kind of not very rigorous. When I went to school, it was at the very beginning of postmodernism, in the late 70s and the early 80s, and the idea of context and contextualism, which we now reject as simplistic, as historical preservation and why match the building next door, we've rejected it in that simplistic way. But it is a it is an argument for context, and it needed all the other stuff to become operative and political and social and urban ways.
I don't know. That's one. Okay. There were a lot of answers. I mean, an answer that I would give, which is more personal to me and not speaking as a firm, but yesterday, I'm one of the things I'm teaching, to my great surprise, is a structures course. All of a sudden, I'm a structures professor, where I was always something else before. And so I started to reread Peter Rice's autobiography. And Peter Rice was a great engineer that worked with Renzo Piano, was the engineer for Pompidou Center and for the Opera House in Sydney and for the DeMille Museum in Houston. Just tremendously talented engineer, one of the great engineers of the century. And he died of a brain tumor very young. But while he was dying, he wrote an autobiography which talked about influences that were important to him. And one of the people he quoted was his boss in the firm that he eventually came to manage, which was Ove Arup. And Ove Arup, who won RIBA gold medal as well, said that he was impressed with his profession, engineering profession, which he lived to 90 years old, that they were able to solve any problem now, that there was nothing that could not be built. But what was sad for him was that within his profession, they couldn't find the right thing to build every time, that there were mistakes made and a lot of really bad decisions on what was important and what people should be thinking about. For me, this is really important, and I really take a lot of pride in the fact that we spend and have dedicated a lot of time to it. And that's like its greatest reward is when that guy comes in and says, oh my God, I wish I could live here. Which is such a beautiful response from somebody who doesn't get to have that kind of response very often. And it's really great.
In that sense, since this is a series of talks that what we're talking about, practice and how do you make a way for yourself, I think a lot of people understand the conditions of postmodernity on a formal level, but that doesn't typically lead them to a civic engagement.
No,
this is this.
And so did that engagement come for you out of a series of positive responses to your work in that area, or is this something that, like you said, the result of it gratifies itself when you have these small victories? How the institution celebrated that tendency in your work?
I mean, to be really outrageously blunt about it, if all that stuff can't solve these problems, it's failed as a project. I mean, just like, you know, Habermas might talk about the failed project of modernity. Well, turning your back isn't solving.
It's not a theoretical project. It's a practical project.
Unfinished project, I guess it calls it. The unfinished project, but it's a failed project. I mean, if all this theory can't deal with these most pertinent issues, then it's failed. I think it can, but I don't think, it's not the easiest.
We get a lot of incredibly good response from the students. I mean, I think that our students are very hungry for a lot of this type of discussion. And so when we run a studio, I was fortunate enough to run a graduate studio that was half industrial design students at Pratt and half architecture students with a guy named Bruce Hanna, who's a furniture designer for Knoll. And that studio, the energy that came on designing temporary shelters, they weren't disaster relief housing. They were just kind of how do you build a house in a factory, getting industrial designers and architects. And the students just were so into it. It was incredible. And so I think that's really a great answer, too.
Yeah.
For all their savviness with computers and all their intellectual whiz-bang reading, they still understood that they could translate that into real practical solutions.
Yeah, what doesn't seem postmodern at all is rather engaged with ameliorating the conditions that postmodernism brings to the fore. Yeah. Like, the issue that really become a problem in postmodernity, he seems to kind of try to lessen their severity. But so that's the first thing.
Yeah.
On that note, when you see the pictures of the home from the homeless project in a gallery, it's very disorienting.
It is.
Very engaged politically. And I was wondering if you could talk, you already alluded to it, but if you could talk more about your response to seeing that project very much decontextualized, almost neither of its political reference. I mean, it
doesn't,
it looks perfect in the gallery, but
yeah, I know. It's so, I don't know what our response was. I mean, we're so mixed. We don't, you know, we are a little bit fringe, and this is not a fringe setting, this gallery. And we were really happy to be able to plunk ourselves in a venue that, you know, usually... it's one of the most sympathetic venues in New York, and yet still, this is not the center of its project. So we want to, you know, why not? I mean, when people sometimes, you know, when I think about it, sometimes when people say, why do you want to, you know, design for these people? I say, well, I want a big client base. You know, this is the biggest client base there is, man. And that's number one. And number two, and I want as much, you know, and I'm saying this kind of tongue-in-cheek, kind of, you know, but I can be as cynical as Johnson and Rim Cool House. You know, I want to be in the center of the world. Give me as much gallery space as you can. I'll take what I can get and I'll use it for my own, you know, we will use it for our own divide, our own mission, you know. So, you know, I wish this was in the courtyard of MoMA. I mean, you know, because who doesn't wish they were in the courtyard?
Well, right now it would look right because it's a construction site.
You know, but the point is, there was a time when this stuff was not so marginal. And you're right, the last moment when that was true was a certain phase of modernism. So we are, but we don't think of, we don't want to be nostalgic for that in any way.
I think also that we don't, while, yeah, this is a gallery and it's white and it's got these nice wood floors, we also think that this is what it should look like when it's real and people are living in it. That this is not going to be put in a place that's a destroyed shell necessarily, that the spaces where the flop houses exist now are the same building. They're just owned by a different body, that they're in these industrial lofts like this one.
The thing that makes this look weird is that it's uninhabited.
Right. Right. No matter how many pretty sheets we bought, you know, it wasn't going to look lived in.
Well, I think another reason why it works in that setting is because you've already appropriated your form from your first point, and that it's a form that can work in luxury conditions, and it's a form that has that brings up attention, but sort of simultaneously resolves it. Mm-hmm. So they're putting it here, it's not altogether so different from putting it in the middle of a beautiful apartment that looks just like that, and adapting to another condition.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see people. Please, if you have to go, please go.
You stayed over the city. Maybe you speak more to the aesthetic dimensions of this learning. I know the questions are already asked.
Well, we're kind of searching for our new. First of all, kind of obviously, view is kind of a dirty word, but. And actually, I teach a course on the history of the community, so I teach a course in classicism, so we can't, it's unavoidable. But I think what we're struggling to do is, in terms of what gives rise to formal, that there is such thing as formal quality as well as quantity, and in trying to find for ourselves, to define for ourselves what are the qualities that we're interested in. We're looking for these qualities to be an extension of a material thinking and a programmatic thinking that used to be called form follows function. It's sometimes called the organic. I think, you know, like a lot of these ideas which come, I mean, form follows function is, or the organic from Horatio Guino. It's not functionalist in a lot of ways. But the thing is, I think that we're searching for sets of qualities that are somehow intrinsic to our problem-solving process, that are not necessarily produced by it or come before it, that it's not a instrumental or deterministic relationship, but it's kind of, they're hooked. Yeah, and that's what we're looking for.
The form follows function quote, the same idea but quoted differently would be every force evolves a form, which is part of the Shaker manifesto, my mother Anne Lee, right? That's the Shaker speaking. And I think that kind of brings in every force evolves a form, brings in a lot of the social concerns that we were talking about before, and that somehow the design of the things that we make will help focus or identify those concerns.
Right.
We'll show a clear relationship.
Right. Yeah, and then but it's not necessarily deterministic. I mean, we understand there's a willfulness, but then we said, well, what if this doesn't look right yet? What additional problems do we want to solve? You know, rather than, you know, where should we tweak it necessarily?
And we find,
how do we heighten it?
Another project we didn't show that we worked on, have been working on for a few years, is a children's school desk for the city of New York. It's kind of next generation school desk, which came out of another competition, and we got this commission. And the development of that idea in this industrialized product, which, you know, we want to sell a million of, the form kept getting better as we kept answering and solving more problems. That the bigger we made the program, the more difficult a hurdle we had to jump over, the better the project got, the more beautiful it got. It really is an attractive object now, no matter what, you know, angle you're coming at it from. And that took 2 years of development, but it's paid dividends because we set our really tough standard and a tough price point. I mean, it had to cost $300. It had to last 17 years. It had to do a million things. I mean, you know, it's like all these problems to solve. And the more we focused on solving those really specific and hard problems, the better the design got, in our estimation.
Thanks for having us.